the bottom line in business. Voice America Business. For Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, welcome to this week's edition of Capital Thinking. We've got a pretty jam-packed show. We're just 26 days from the election. We've got four key topics we want to bring to you. We're going to talk about the impact of the financial crisis on state and city and local government budgets. Then we're going to talk about the bill that President Bush signed into law yesterday allowing nuclear deals with the great state of India and the United States for the first time in 35 years. In our third block, we'll be talking about the state of wireless communications law and what's expected in the FCC and the halls of Congress in the next 2 years. And in the last block, we'll be taking your emails and phone calls about the state of the election. But we're going to turn first to talk about the impact of the financial crisis on state and local government. We've got three distinguished guests with us. First is Ray Shepik, who is the executive director of the National Governors Association. He's joined by Katie Whalen, who's the former executive director of the Democratic Governors Association and a former senior advisor to California's Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. And our third guest is Merrick Gutman, who's annually recognized as one of Washington, D.C.'s best lobbyists for state and local governments. We want to start by asking Ray a question. Ray, welcome to the show, and want to have you give us a quick overview of tough times out there for the states. What are the things the governors are dealing with in the midst of this financial crisis?
Well, there's a couple of things. First is the very short-run problem of some states trying to get short-term capital, like California, Massachusetts, just to get them through the next 30 days, and that credit market seems to have been closed. And then the other short-run problem is floating infrastructure bonds. Sometimes you go to the market and there's no buyer, so that's a problem. The second problem, which I think is more serious, is this downturn that started last December with a fall off in primarily sales tax and corporate tax has now accelerated quite dramatically. And so the feeling is now that this downturn and the impact on states is probably going to be worse than the last three downturns. It may not be quite as bad as the one in 1981-1982, but that means the worst we've seen in 25 years.
And you've obviously been at the NGA through a couple of those downturns, and you were at the Congressional Budget Office during the, I believe, that first downturn that you mentioned. What can we expect to see? How will state governments be hammered if the tax revenues continue to decline? What sort of tough choices are on their horizon?
Well, I think you got to remember we're already almost a year into this, so they've done a lot of the drawing down of rainy day funds and some of the easy cuts. So I think from here you're going to see some fairly significant cuts in elementary and secondary education and higher education, two areas that they've tried to protect in the past, and also Medicaid in terms of case eligibility and benefits, because there's going to be, you know, the average state's probably going to cut 5 to 8% before they even begin to look at the revenue side of the equation. So it's going to be real tough.
Let me shift to you, Katie. You've been in the room when a governor of the nation's largest state's making these big decisions. How do you balance some of these competing interests between Medicaid and higher education and everybody clamoring for a raise? What are some of the choices that the governors are going to face in trying to make up this revenue?
Well, as Ray said, they're going to have some real tough choices to make, and the Medicaid budget is 23% of a state budget. And that can only grow if, as the economic situation plays itself out over the next 2 years. There's going to be real tough choices to make on, in addition to education, public safety, and in funding the very badly needed capital projects that we have in infrastructure, roads, and infrastructure investment overall, which will also, it's going to be very tough. So it's a balancing act, Kevin, and we just have to take it one day at a time to see what we can do.
Yeah, I know here in my home state, I woke up to the news this morning. The governor was on announcing that he's cut his pay by 5% and he's going to stop buying bottled water at the office to save money. And he's mm-hmm. about to announce some very dramatic cutbacks across the board that I think are going to make some state employees unhappy with their future and make some agencies really have some challenges going forward. Let's get it down to the local level and talk to you a little bit, Merrick. I know you've been out on the road since Congress has been out. You've been out visiting some counties and some major cities across the country. What are the mayors and the city council members and the city managers feeling about the crunch? How does it impact them?
Well, it's very, very depressing, actually, to talk to some of the mayors and the county executives because it's getting painful. As Ray said, the problems with the budget and the initial downturns in the economy were being felt over the past year, maybe 2 years, and this situation is ramping up the problems in a couple of critical areas, both the financial side and then on the service delivery side. As you know, local governments, both cities and counties, are the primary service deliverers, and they're financed from the federal government and perhaps even more significantly from the state government. But when an economic downturn happens, there are lots of consequences for the kinds of things that local governments need to provide to their citizens. The needs of the citizens increase while the economic downturn forces budgetary constraints on the local government. So in the financial side, you're looking at problems in pensions. New York City, for example, between June and September lost about $230 million in their pension because of the Wall Street situation. But then, even more significantly, in the tax basis. Unlike downturns you saw in 2001, 2002, where the property tax base, real estate remained relatively stable, even hot, and made up for concerns about sales tax revenue, gas tax revenue decreases, and even some in the income tax area for those localities that can tap income taxes, this is all about property taxes. So across the country, on average, National League of Cities survey of CFOs indicated more than a 3.5% reduction in property tax revenues. Sales taxes down by more than 4%. Income taxes for those places that can impose income taxes down by more than 3.3%. So this is obviously an enormous financial burden on just delivering what local governments need to do within the amount of money that they're taking.
You do a good job of outlining the problem, so let's talk a little bit about solutions. What are cities and counties going to come to Washington or to their local taxpayers this fall or next year and say, this is what we need help doing?
Well, the federal government, fundamentally, the core thing that the federal government can do is implement the foreclosure stabilization effort effectively, because if you're able to stabilize the property tax base in these communities, then maybe by 2010, 2011, things will be turning around. That's number one, the most immediate action, aside from pumping more money into both states and localities to offset the budget impacts. Unfortunately, what typically happens, and Ray can comment on this, is that states, when they face a budgetary constraint, either cut payments to localities, shift costs to localities for the services to be picked up, or in some instances need to reach down and take money from localities or local government related agencies like California and the redevelopment agencies in order to make up the state budget. So the other thing that the federal government needs to do is stop, if at all possible, given the broad federal budget limitations, stop making cuts. Last year we saw a 60% reduction in the justice assistance grants, which is core operating dollars to local governments and public safety in order to maintain their activities. You know, I'll give you one quick example and I'll let others comment, but in King County, Seattle, one of the top 13 urban counties in the country, $90 million budget deficit coming up this year because about $55 million attributable to the financial crisis means 11% cuts being imposed from the sheriff. That's about 100 deputies and staff that they'll need to cut back at a time when crime, tracking the economy, Crime increases when the economy suffers.
Going up, sure, exactly. Well, Ray, let's turn back to you and ask sort of the same question. What's in the solution grab bag for the governors as they come to Washington and look to work with Congress and a new administration?
Well, there's in the short run, I think, is to see whether states can't also borrow like the private sector has to either the Federal Reserve or the Treasury, and we're kind of investigating those things now.
Katie's old boss, Schwarzenegger, seemed like he wanted to be the first one to dip into that.
He clearly was. It'll be interesting to see whether he's successful or not. The same thing would be during the next administration. Our sense is that, you know, the downturn is going to be fairly significant. So one of the best approaches for the federal government in terms of any stimulus, really, is to provide money to state and local government, because both are make what we call pro-cyclical decisions. In other words, their cuts in programs and or increases in taxes only make the recession more severe. So most economists would argue that getting some funds to state and local government so that they do not have to do that is one of the more successful programs. Actually, in 2003, we did get a package of $10 billion of sort of general revenue sharing, and then an additional $10 billion of federal aid injected into Medicaid, which actually did offset a lot of the negative impacts. One of the things that we always have to keep in mind for states, which is the biggest impact, is actually the year after the recession is over, because that's when you get the phenomenal explosion in Medicaid costs. So even though the recession last time started in 2001-2002, that bailout package came at a very good time, because it was 2003 that would have had the major impact on states.
Now, Katie, I want to turn back to California for a minute and ask you, you know, we've got a huge election coming up. The governor's not up there, but I believe a significant chunk of the state house and state senators are up there. How does this impact in any state the election process and what people are out there saying and what they can do in the future once they get into office? We see California maybe calling a special session to deal with the emergency legislation related to finances, and I presume other states might follow as well. Is that right?
Well, it looks like obviously every state is impacted on this, and they are all reporting mid-year budget gaps, and so they may all have to come back in and have special sessions. And in any statewide election or national election, usually comes down to who's the economy and who's doing the job, and do you hire or fire the folks that were leading you and to lead you on to the next couple of years. So we'll see how that falls out in California and all around the country.
Ray, one last real quick question. That is there anything specific that Congress can do to prop up the housing market in the states that they haven't already done to bring property tax revenue back into line?
I don't know. I mean, I think one of the keys there, the problem is even this bailout plan doesn't get down to the individual homeowner because that's all the securitized loans. But how do you do that is fairly difficult. But unfortunately, our sense is that housing prices probably have to fall another 5 to 10%.
All right, Ray, I'm going to have to let you go there. We really appreciate having Ray, Katie, and Merrick on. You're listening to Capital Thinking on the Voice America Business Network.
Talk about his money. Call us toll-free, 866-472-5790, and talk to the experts. We talk money all the time. Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Hola, this is Paquito de Rivera inviting you to join me, Ramsey Lewis, Didi Bridgewater, McCoy Tyner, and many, many others at Washington, D.C.'s Duke Ellington Jazz Festival, October 1 to 7. Enjoy more than 100 performances at 35 venues across the city. Check it out, www.dejazzfest.org.
Duke Ellington Jazz Festival is sponsored in part with a grant from the Government of the District of Columbia, Adrian M. Fenty, Mayor, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the D.C. Commission on the Arts and Humanities.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hey, out of my way!
Welcome to Washington Gridlock. Patton Boggs' legal team can make sense of it all. We know how Washington works. We've been sorting it out for the past 46 years. We have what it takes. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs. We deliver the insights you need to stay on top of your game.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The Internet's only all business and financial radio network, Voice America Business.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. We're going to delve now into one of the issues that hasn't gotten the level of attention it really deserves in this hectic political environment this fall with the financial crisis and a looming election, but it's really one of the more fascinating topics to pass through Washington in recent years, and that's the deal that was cut between the United States and India regarding civilian nuclear technology. We're joined by three guests today. I want to welcome in Ted Jones, who's the executive director of the U.S.-India Business Council's with us today, and we also have Robert Kapla and Anu Varma, who are attorneys with Patton Boggs. Both of them helped quarterback the agreement that President Bush just signed into law yesterday. Ted, I want to thank you for joining us, and I want to ask you to tell us a little bit about your job there at the U.S.-India Business Council and what it is that you all do here in Washington.
Thanks, Kevin. U.S.-India Business Council is a trade association. We represent 300 of the largest U.S. companies trading and investing in India today. We are chaired by Indra Nooyi. We're in our 34th year, having been founded in 1975 at the suggestion of then-Secretary of State Henry Kissinger to deepen commercial ties between the U.S. and India. 1975 was one of the low points. That was during the emergency with Indira Gandhi, and things have turned around so much since then. Since 1991, when the Indian economy opened, the U.S.-India commercial relationship took off, and it is growing on an upward curve, a steep upward curve, and our membership and our activity is expanding apace. So we have a lot more to do every year. We're working in all business sectors, and increasingly we're doing two-way trade investing, including Indian companies, India's rising global companies that are investing in the United States. They are also our members now.
And Ted, I think I promoted you. I gave you a better title. Your boss may be listening and wondering if he lost his job, but you're actually the Director of Policy Advocacy and Business Development there at the Council. And
correct.
I guess my question is, how big is that trade market between the United States and India right now?
It's enormous, and it's growing exponentially. We are India's second largest trading partner, even separated half a world away, and it's just getting larger every year. I think it's doubling every 3 years.
Wow, great. Well, tell us a little bit about the law that President Bush signed yesterday, and Anu and Robert, please chime in here. I know you guys have a little bit of, give us a thumbnail sketch of what this law means for the United States and for India.
Well, just briefly, India never signed a non-proliferation treaty, and so they had been frozen out of commercial nuclear trade with the world from the early 1970s, even though India had been a very responsible steward of nuclear technology, unlike its neighbor Pakistan, which we know opened a nuclear Walmart and proliferated technology all over the place. India has maintained the same kinds of controls over its materials and technology as the United States and other responsible powers. And it was time, I think, some very far-sighted visionary thinkers decided years ago to mainstream India and bring them within the non-proliferation mainstream, began to trade with them in this peaceful nuclear technology so they could expand their thirsty nuclear power sector. And this is what we have done. It was a huge lift. It required a lot of creative thinking and a lot of very smart advocacy from Pat and Boggs.
Well, yeah, let's
may I add that the agreement, though focusing on opening up the nuclear energy sector and serving India's massive need for non-fossil fuel energy to feed its 10% a year growth in the economy, it also became something larger. It actually became a symbol of the deepening of strategic and commercial ties between the two countries. And these types of ties have never, ever existed between India and the United States, and India being the world's largest democracy and U.S. being the world's oldest and strongest democracy. It's quite a striking agreement in its symbolism and what it means for the ties between the two countries.
Well, that's excellent. Tell me a little bit about what sort of things from America will India be able to buy under the terms of this agreement? You know, the first thing that sort of came to my mind was perhaps a company like GE must make significant parts for the nuclear industry worldwide. Are they the types of American companies that India will be purchasing from in the future because of this deal?
Kevin, you put your finger on it. GE is probably going to be the biggest winner of all, together with Westinghouse. They are
why I told Buffett to invest that $3 billion.
They are the two U.S. companies that build commercial nuclear reactors, and they will be key players as India moves toward expanding its nuclear power sector by 30,000 to 60,000 megawatts between now and 2030. To put that into some perspective, 1 megawatt in nuclear power is about $2 to $2.5 billion. It's a huge opportunity. There's also parts manufacturers, there's fuel suppliers. It's a huge trade that's reviving already in the United States as we're reconsidering nuclear power. But even as U.S. companies haven't been building plants in the United States, they've been building them all over the world, so they're very well positioned to take advantage of this growing opportunity in India.
And broader, going to the point that we just discussed a minute ago, a number of companies outside of the nuclear energy sector, a number of American companies outside of those getting direct benefits, such as GE, Westinghouse, and the components manufacturers, such as companies in the financial services sector and others, all joined in this effort to get this bill passed because it did signal India becoming a place that we, the United States and our foreign policy, consider to be a reliable partner, and vice versa, and everybody across the board benefits with that.
Yeah, I want to delve a little deeper into sort of the legislative work done here, guys. You know, my sense is that it's been very difficult in this Congress to get any sort of trade legislation through for a variety of reasons involving, you know, various perspectives on protectionism and environmental issues. I imagine you faced both those challenges, but was this something where you had more of a barrier to overcome with conservatives or liberals, or was this something that was firmly embraced by both sides of the aisle in both the House and the Senate?
I think, Kevin, this has always been a two-step process. Congress has been required to approve two different things two different times. Anytime you're dealing with a foreign policy issue, you're dealing with two different countries, two different cultures, two different sets of political issues and priorities that both governments are trying to handle. But you're also dealing with, in this case, the very controversial of quote-unquote nuclear. We did a lot of education up front trying to convince people we're not talking about strategic nuclear weapons. This is about providing power, civilian nuclear power to India. So that was kind of an early hurdle that we had to get ourselves over. This had also had a climate change component, which tended to resonate well with the Democratic Party. India burns a lot of dirty coal to provide power. So nuclear power advocates had something involved in this battle, but both times, you know, we had to get two separate pieces of legislation passed and signed into law, and that's never an easy thing.
And to highlight, you know, what Robert just said, you know, this really was bipartisan. That this was a Bush administration initiative, the initial agreement and the legislation that followed. The talks were started much earlier. Some have reported as early as the last year of Bill Clinton's tenure. And going forward, what the U.S. Congress had to do in 2006, and more importantly, in a bipartisan sense, this year, is decide that they were going to give the president a victory because it was a victory for everybody. And for the Democratic Party, their choice was, we need to move the ball forward with India and not get wrapped up in partisanship of who gets what victory, because it's a victory for the whole Congress. And I think that discussion, when the dialogue turned in that direction, that was very favorable for those of us who are advocating for quick passage.
Well, I know you guys had taken a run at this, a serious run in 2006 in that congressional session. What was the difference? What put you over the top between 2006 and this year?
Well, I think 2006, the first thing we had to do was amend the Atomic Energy Act of 1954 to simply allow the United States and India to even talk to one another about civilian nuclear power. As Ted said, because India is not a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, they're barred under the U.S. is barred under the Atomic Energy Act from even talking about that issue. So step one was amending the Atomic Energy Act and carve out a special treatment of India. So we got that done, and that was the first time we raised this issue. I think a lot of our work, upfront work, was done back in 2006. All the education, all the the talking points we did on the various issues that popped up, fighting back the opposition that was pushing this as a way for India to increase its strategic nuclear stockpile. So we did a lot of that then. Step two was once that was passed, the U.S. and India began talking about what's called the 123 agreement.
I'm going to have to cut you guys off there. We're running out of time. I want to thank Rob, Anu, and Ted for joining us and talking about this deal. We'll be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks. Thank you.
Money, money. Up-to-date business and financial news. Money, money. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola. Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Merhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
From the stock market floor to your laptop, we are Voice America Business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. It's time to talk a little bit about telecommunications law and the state of where things stand in that area. I want to remind you, if you want to call into the show, our call-in number is 866-472-5790. Our guest to this segment is Jennifer Richter. She's the chair of the Technology and Communications Practice Group for the law firm of Patton Boggs, based here in Washington, D.C., someone who brings a great deal of experience having worked for a wireless communications company that eventually sold itself to Sprint and also worked in private practice. Jennifer now handles a wide variety of telecommunications law issues before the Federal Communications Commission, the United States Congress, and probably some other alphabet soup agencies that we'll get a chance to talk about here. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Let me start by saying, we're real close to an election, but I imagine that the FCC is not sitting on their thumbs waiting to find out who the next president will be. So what are the things on their agenda here for the rest of 2008?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right about that, and it's an exciting time for us in the communications bar because the chairman has teed up a number of initiatives that he's trying to get done before January, and many of the decisions actually relate to making more wireless broadband spectrum available for broadband deployments across the country. And for the listeners who aren't familiar, there is this opportunity to deploy wireless broadband networks across the country as opposed to broadband that you might receive over DSL or cable or fiber. And the great advantage to it is that it's really cost effective because you don't have to, dig up streets and trench cabling. And so It's a great solution for providing broadband services, especially to people in rural and underserved areas. And I think everyone believes this is going to be the big answer to bridging that digital divide and bringing broadband truly across the nation. So among the decisions that the chairman is considering trying to get done here before the end of the year are there's a rulemaking, a wireless communications service, SDARS rulemaking that's been pending actually for 10 years. And it looks like we're getting down to the short strokes here to finish up the technical rules so that 30 megahertz of spectrum can be made available for these wireless broadband services.
Is that a lot of spectrum?
You know, it's as opposed to the spectrum that Sprint Clearwire, the new Clearwire, will have, which is like 200 megahertz of spectrum, 30 megahertz of spectrum is actually a sufficient amount of spectrum to be able to provide services, especially in rural areas where you might not have as much demand for broadband as you might have in a major metropolitan area. So there's that 30 megahertz of spectrum at 2.3 gigahertz. There's another rulemaking, the AWS-3 rulemaking, that's been really hot. It's another 20 megahertz of spectrum, just slightly down on the band at 2.1 gigahertz. Some people have been advocating for that spectrum to be auctioned, and others have advocated for it to be made available on an unlicensed or lightly licensed basis, which would be really interesting because then carriers wouldn't be spending a lot of money to acquire the spectrum, and the savings that they realize in not having to spend it on the spectrum, they can then drive back into the network and perhaps reduce costs for consumers. So that's really interesting, and Chairman Martin's actually been supporting some proposals to make a free public broadband network over this AWS-3 spectrum. So that's one to watch. And the chairman's sort of looking at the WCS and AWS-3 rulemakings in a similar vein because some of the engineering issues are similar. So we do expect to see both of those either at the November or the December meeting. And I met with Chairman Martin earlier this week, and he indicated that.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. Let me shift from the FCC and talk a little bit about, what Congress might be focused on, both now and if there is a little more session left this year, or perhaps looking forward into the new Congress, what you anticipate might be some of their top legislative priorities. Is this one of the things you think the new Congress will really be focused on, is FCC issues?
Well, you know, given all other priorities and what's happening in the financial markets and with, our energy crisis, I'm not sure that communications issues are going to be on the top of every legislator's list. But I can tell you that over the last year, there's been a lot of concern about a national broadband strategy and making sure that we get broadband to everyone across the country because that's really how we all communicate, and that's certainly a way of spurring on business and innovation and hopefully some, economic progress. So a national broadband strategy has been top of mind. Recently, the House Energy and Commerce Committee has been engaging in a letter-writing campaign about behavioral online advertising practices and whether consumer behavior online or even in using their mobile device is being tracked or collected in a way that consumers aren't aware of so that providers can push advertising to people if they're, in a certain neighborhood, to push advertising to them about a great coffee place that's around the corner.
We won't be safe anywhere soon, right? So we won't be safe from advertising anywhere.
Well, that's right. So there are some real consumer issues there, and whether consumers realize that this information is being tracked and collected and then being used not only to provide advertising to them, but then the concern is that there are other greater privacy concerns. And so I think you'll see Congress really focusing on consumer privacy issues as well.
What about how do you see the outcome of the election, Obama versus McCain? Does that impact the direction that you see the next FCC or next Congress taking if one in particular wins the presidency over the other?
You know, I think it inevitably does, because the president chooses the chair of the Federal Communications Commission, and so hopefully he's choosing a person, or predictably he will choose a person who reflects his priorities.
Did you want to announce your candidacy for the job here on the air?
I think I already have, but Senator Obama's talked a lot about having the nation's first chief technology officer, and that one of the core issues for that individual would be overseeing the development of a national interoperable wireless network for first responders and public safety. So that's really interesting and sort of a new concept. But I think both Obama and McCain will be focused on national broadband strategies and on universal service reform and, you know, making sure that we're getting broadband and funds out there. There's no question that who is at the helm of the FCC really helps to chart course there and for our industry. And, you know, Chairman Powell before Chairman Martin was really a deregulatory force for the industry, and that had really far-reaching implications that I think Congress is still grappling with. Chairman Martin has done amazing things for wireless policy and getting more wireless spectrum out there for services. So it'll be real interesting to see who's at the helm next.
Well, you know, you raise a very good question. Actually, a couple things come out of what you just said. One is the issue of first responders having a wireless interoperable network is one that came obviously to prominent attention after 9/11. And I know a lot of federal money was sort of directed to help local governments purchase that equipment, but it still seems like 7 years later we're a long ways away from having true interoperability. What are the hurdles here?
Well, that's absolutely right. I think there are a couple of hurdles. One of them, though, is this 700 megahertz rulemaking that's pending at the FCC. I think this was on the list of things that Chairman Martin wanted to get done before the end of the year, but that's not likely to happen. And they're trying to make available 20 megahertz of spectrum for a private-public partnership that will enable the construction and deployment of this nationwide network. But you know, the details of that and how to really work through the issues with all of the first responders at the local, regional, and national level have proven to be very difficult and sometimes contentious, and so that rulemaking has really been caught up. I would say, though, notwithstanding that, I've seen some excellent examples in the marketplace of public safety and government organizations saying, we're not waiting for 700 megahertz. Up in New York, first responders are using a completely different spectrum band, and they're working with Northrop Grumman and NextWave on this really innovative wireless broadband technology that provides for first responders the kind of excellent broadband capability that most of us have as consumers and really will help them to do their jobs better, give them, you know, video and voice and data, which is so critical to have in the field when you're responding to an emergency. You know, locally, Fairfax County's entered into a contract for a broadband deployment of their own, again, not using 700 megahertz and not waiting for that. You know, first responders up in Jackson, Wyoming are contracting with Digital Bridge Communications to have that kind of mobile wireless broadband technology in their vehicles. So I think, you know,
we're seeing progress is what you're saying,
yes,
even though we're not all the way there.
No, and you know, and you will see the 700 megahertz rulemaking and getting it concluded and then getting that spectrum out there will definitely be number one on the agenda for the next FCC administration.
A couple real quick questions. We've got less than 2 minutes left here, Jennifer. Are we behind Europe and Japan? Are we substantially catching up to them in the wireless world?
Well, you know, for broadband deployments and even for, you know, wireless broadband deployments, we're pretty significantly behind. I think we're 18th or 19th in the rankings in the world in terms of broadband deployments. And certainly for wireless, many countries in Europe, Asia, they adopted wireless first because it is so much less expensive to deploy than cable, DSL, or fiber. So we're behind. We've got a lot of work to do, and I think that's why you see Congress and the FCC and public interest groups, frankly, really focusing on a national broadband strategy.
Let me interrupt you there because we're going to have to
sure.
wrap up, but I want to ask you a real quick question. Direct the digital TV transition early next year, is it the next 2001 bug? Is it going to be a dud, or is it going to be a real challenge for the public when they turn the TV on and millions don't have digital signal?
You know, I think the FCC's been working real hard and NTIA has been working really hard to get the word out to make sure people know, and they've been actually running some tests, which has been interesting. I think in Wilmington, Delaware recently, they had all the public broadcasters turn off their analog signals
right.
in favor of digital and just to see what kind of calls they were getting in. Now, I think the FCC reported that test was largely a success, but I think public interest groups felt that there was still a lot of concern by consumers that they didn't understand it. So, that, you know, February will be an interesting time.
Yeah, it sure will. It makes me thankful. I've had my satellite in place for quite a while, and reception is good. All HDTV. I want to thank Jennifer Richter for joining us. We're going to be back in just a minute taking your listener phone calls and emails talking about Election 2008. You're listening to the Capital Thinking on the Voice America Business Network.
Stocks, bonds, 401ks, investments, refinancing. We can help you. Call now toll-free, 866-472-5790, 866-472-5790. Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Hola, this is Paquito de Rivera, inviting you to join me, Ramsey Lewis, Didi Bridgewater, McCoy Tyner, and many, many others at Washington, D.C.'s Yucalicon Jazz Festival, October 1 to 7. Enjoy more than 100 performances at 35 venues across the city. Check it out, www.dejazzfest.org.
Duke Ellington Jazz Festival is sponsored in part with a grant from the Government of the District of Columbia, Adrian M. Fenty, Mayor, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the D.C. Commission on the Arts and Humanities.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The bottom line in business. Voice America Business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. I'm Kevin O'Neill. You'd like to call in this segment and ask a question about the election this fall. Our call-in number is 866-472-5790. We've got a stack of emails here from some of our callers already, and we're going to get to those in just a minute. We're going to start by talking a little bit about the debates We're now three-quarters of the way through debate season. We've had two presidential debates and the lone vice presidential debate. We've got just one more to come next week, and the question is whether or not any of that will be, to use the term of the fall, a game changer. So far, we've not seen any real fireworks in these three debates. I want to talk a little bit about the vice presidential debate. I think Sarah Palin met everybody's expectations last week, which were extraordinarily low expectations thanks to the media spending so much time hammering her on everything, every issue you can imagine, involving her family, her professional experience, etc. And she clearly hurdled the bar of expectations there. She did a good job commanding the facts that she had. Did she know everything? No, of course she didn't, but she's got a good excuse for that. See, it turns out she's been governing her state for 2 years, and she wasn't focused on foreign policy and some of the other things that she might be focused on if she was a congressman or senator in Washington and didn't have to worry about actually administering anything in her day job. But I thought she did very well. But it doesn't seem to have had any impact on the polls, except to perhaps clear some concern in voters' minds, particularly among some independents, that she's not a drag on the ticket. Joe Biden, I think, met everyone's expectations as well. People expected him to dominate and show a command of the facts and to be very careful about not patronizing Governor Palin. I think he executed the job there fairly well. It's interesting in looking at the postmortems from the debate that there were a lot of factual misstatements made by Senator Biden that were pretty easily refuted. We're not talking about things that Biden could say were colorable. You know, I see that this way, and somebody on the opposite side of the political aisle sees it another way. No, in fact, we really were talking about clear factual misstatements. In fact, in many cases, things where he had himself criticized Barack Obama earlier in the primary season for taking specific stands, saying he would meet with foreign leaders without precondition, and then trying to backtrack here in the debate. And I think that if people looked closely at that, that might have had a negative drag on where Biden stood and where Obama Biden stood. But if you look at the poll results since the vice presidential debate, you don't see any of that impact. So we're going to turn to one of our debate-related questions here. It comes from Greg in Clemson, South Carolina. His question is, do the presidential debates serve the same purpose or the expected outcome today as when they started back in 1960? Greg, thank you for your question. Appreciate that. And it's a good one. The debates have really changed over time. In 1960, of course, Nixon probably had the worst makeup artist of all time, and that helped him look extraordinarily old next to the youthful, vital, and well-spoken John Kennedy. Nixon wasn't ready for the television era, and John Kennedy probably used that debate to devastating advantage to help close what would be an extraordinarily close election in 1960. Over time, we've seen some pretty tremendous moments in debate history. You've got There You Go Again, Ronald Reagan. You've got Where's the Beef. You've got you've got Geraldine Ferraro and George Bush having a pretty memorable showdown in their own vice presidential debate 24 years ago. Lloyd Benson dissing Dan Quayle, saying he knows Jack Kennedy and you're no Jack Kennedy. But what we've evolved into, Greg, is more and more just a chance for the candidates to get up and recite their talking points. And I think this week's debate was a tremendous loss of opportunity for the American people. Here you had 80 average Americans that were carefully screened to sit on the stage because they were supposedly independent voters who hadn't yet made up their mind. And the questions they asked were very disappointing. And I thought Brokaw played a tremendous interference, really interfered with the flow of the debate and the chance for citizens to ask questions. There was no opportunity to follow up, no opportunity for give and take with the candidates, and very limited opportunity for them to interact with one another. And what we heard, for anybody who's been watching the election closely, was a set of talking points that, frankly, we could have sent some surrogates who just watched the debates and watched the commercials to deliver for themselves. And I think that's very frustrating. That could have been a great format. What I'd love to see is a format where they agree to show up and the moderator stands back and only makes sure that they each get relatively equal time to talk, and they pull some questions off the Internet, or they let some people ask some questions unscreened. They let folks follow up, maybe more like a press conference. We get a chance to see these guys think on their feet. I don't think anyone thought that what happened Tuesday night was anything more than canned answers. Where they fell back on their talking points. We saw the same thing in the vice presidential debate. You don't like the question, just change it to one of the things that you know the answer to. And we didn't learn a whole lot. Perhaps the only thing new we heard in the whole debate on Tuesday night was that John McCain suddenly and miraculously had this idea to bail out a bunch of homeowners, and it left a lot of people scratching their heads. Seemed like an odd place to announce a major new $300 billion initiative and not be able to fill in the blanks and not be able to do a relatively good job of connecting the dots to the rest of your campaign. Let's turn now to another question that we have here. Our next question comes from, Bob in Kansas City. Are there large-scale voting fraud issues the media talking about due to a large number of voters, or is this being overplayed? Well, it's a good question, Bob. The voter fraud issues do seem very legitimate. Right now, Fox has been running a great deal of segments on Acorn and their voter fraud challenges in about 12 states, and I think it would be a shame if either candidate wins the presidential election and it's tainted by claims that too many people have been registered. There's a story out today that Indianapolis has 105% of its population registered to vote, and that seems pretty extraordinary. That seems like the city of Chicago quite a long time ago. Let's go back and try and work in at least one more question here. This is from Mike in Los Angeles. Given the waning enthusiasm for Palin in the McCain campaign, if McCain could go back in time, would he pick a different running mate? Well, let's answer that for both. I think that McCain would pick the same running mate. There wasn't a deep bench to pick from. He needed someone who would rev up the base, and he needed someone that could at least make an attempt to play both to independents and to women, and in Sarah Palin he found the person. It's not his fault he couldn't get her to connect. I think Barack Obama, whether he wins or loses, will always look back and wonder if Hillary Clinton was the right choice. All right, that does it for this episode of Capital Thinking. Join us again next week. You've been listening to Capital Thinking on the Voice America Business Network.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.